Hi there. My name is Ishmael Ozan, and many of you know me as the Dane County District Attorney, but I am also a husband and a father of two young girls. Today, I am asking you to make the choice my wife and I made to not use physical punishment with our children. Many of us are not aware that over 16 years ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics urged doctors to recommend that parents not use physical punishment on their children. Today, over 100 years of research on children and families supports this recommendation. Look, well-meaning parents may use physical discipline intending to teach their children to make good choices, but we now know that physical discipline actually leads to more disobedience and aggressive behaviors in children. We all want what is best for our kids. Today, we now know what is best for kids is parenting based on respect, mutual understanding, and logic, rather than fear of physical pain. Please join me in learning more about positive parenting and creating a violence-free home.
Paid for by the Dane County District Attorney's Office with support from UW Health American Family Children's Hospital.
I want to welcome a new sponsor to SliceOffice.com. The attorneys at Gingras, Thompson, and Wachs have had the honor of receiving numerous awards for their work both in and outside the courtroom. But just as important as receiving accolades for being skilled attorneys, it's equally important to give back to the community in which they live and work. If you want a personal attorney that can help you in so many different areas, they've got them. They're in Eau Claire, Madison, Milwaukee, and Waukesha. They're easy to reach. GTWLawyers.com. That's GTWLawyers.com.
Welcome to another podcast at SliceOffice.com, brought to you by our friends at the Operating Engineers Local 139, also Chef's Guitar Clinic and Madison Computer Works. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. John, before we get started today, I thought I'd give you the opportunity to say a few words about the passing of Ron McCrae, who worked at the Capital Times and, of course, was the press secretary for former Governor Tony Earl.
I appreciate that. So I didn't know you were going to say that or ask, but Ron was a remarkable person. And those a lot of people knew Ron Madison, Ron Wisconsin, around the country knew him. He's one of those people who was always the smartest person in the room. I mean, that I promise you, when he came in that room, he was the smartest person there. And yet his first interaction with you, whether he'd seen you the day before, whether he'd seen you, you know, 10 years, hadn't seen you in 10 years, was, hey, what's going on with you? And, oh, I just saw something you did, or I just, you know, heard somebody said something nice. He had a stunning skill, which is a journalistic skill, for putting people at ease, making them wanna, you know, join in a really deep, smart conversation. He knew everything about politics in Wisconsin. He knew, you know, the journalism game from top to bottom. He's an expert as regards Frank Lloyd Wright. Had written books and essays and done all sorts of things. He's probably most famous for one headline in the journal, Milwaukee Journal, back in I guess it was early 1983, late 1982, when he was appointed press secretary, and the headline was. I may slightly mischaracterize it, but it was avowed homosexual to be press chief. He was made Tony Earl's press secretary. And Ron had been very, very active in the LGBTQ community in the very early days, as well as a leader at the Cap Times. But the interesting thing was there was some national controversy around in those days. And what was fascinating was, of course, Ron offered immediately to step down if Earl wanted him to. Earl stuck with him, and of course. And within a couple of days, everybody was working with Ron. And, you know, it was like the absurdity of suggesting that one's sexuality or one's, you know, any other characteristic someone ought to keep him out of a position was just blown out of the water by the fact that Ron was so good at it and so likable, frankly. But the final thing I'll tell you is, and his was such a long journey, we could do a whole show and it wouldn't be enough. And the final thing I'd add is that in 1977, as a really well-established person at the Cap Times, when the pressmen walked out on strike against Madison newspapers, he led the guild, or was a leading figure in the newspaper guild that walked out with him in solidarity, and quickly became editor of the Press Connection, which was the daily newspaper that was created during the period of strike. It was a extremely fine daily newspaper that ended up being nationally recognized and really well respected. He was profiled by Studs Terkel and people like that. And so, you know, just basically everything he did through a long life turned out to be a success and to be really special and important. He died of after a really tough fight with cancer, and he leaves his wife,
Elaine de Schmidt,
who was
a wonderful woman who I worked with on the Carter campaign in 1980. So I've known her for 40 years. Yeah. What a remarkable combination! And you know, he saved her life. She had a heart attack.
Yeah,
and he saw the early signs and saved her life. But what an interesting combination they were. He's had a fascinating life, to say the least. But yeah, he came to my mother's funeral.
Yep.
And, you know, but he was not afraid to put me in my place. He, you know, for as liberal he was in some ways, he was very conservative in others. You know, if I used language was a little blue, he did not like that.
He was, well, the thing about him, and this is the only way to say it, right? He was dignified.
Right. And
he
I'm not.
Well, I think it goes without saying. No, he was dignified, and he had a class, a persona.
Right.
He was a very tall man, and he carried it very well, in the sense that, you know, you'd have this guy who, especially if he dressed up, boy, if he put the suit and tie on, he looked like this imposing figure, and the two things about him were that it was always classy. It was always dignified. That was one thing. And the other thing was, again, this is how I started out, because I think it was so important. He always put an incredible effort into making whoever he was talking to feel like they were the center of the discussion. That is a very rare talent.
And he was sincere about it.
Yeah, it wasn't some campaign.
No.
For office. No, it was, but it was natural. And he was a true journalist, third generation. His dad and grandfather were editors. One of the most wonderful things, the stories as regards Ron, is that, and by the way, he was focused in Madison, but whenever things changed or job was done or whatever, he went around the country. He always got jobs on major papers, you know, across the country, Newsday and Washington Post, Washington Star. He worked with them at different times. You know, he was really, really good at what he did. But intriguingly enough, he did love Madison. He did circle back to Madison. And in tremendous tribute to Dave Zweifel, the longtime editor of the Capital Times, in the 90s when Ron had been working out east, I think it was at New York Newsday or Long Island Newsday, the area he was working on folded. He could have obviously gone on to some other paper. Dave drew him back to the Cap Times, and I got to work with Ron a lot in the late 90s, early 2000s, and this is probably the subtlety of the guy that people may not know. You know, he was in the New York tabloid market as an editor, and one of the reasons for that is I have never, ever, and I promise you, somebody's been around journalism for a very long time in a lot of ways, never, ever met a better headline writer. You could throw him a story, complex, a million things going on, he would have it down to two words. And it would be the right...
The right words, yeah.
It would. It's kind of an amazing talent.
Well, I remember having the Press Connection delivered to my high school classroom at James Madison Memorial. So I'm hoping I was on the right track in 1979.
Well, obviously you were.
So, speaking of the wrong track, I'm not sure where this is coming from, and maybe you can explain it to me. But in particular, Chuck Todd, who on numerous occasions over the last year has, you know, given the clarion call about Trump's lawlessness, has decided to start poo-pooing impeachment. And he brought Peggy Noonan on the other day.
Oh, well, that's, and if you're going to poo-poo.
Right. The unctuous Peggy Noonan. You've got to listen to this conversation.
It strikes me most about this moment as we journey now at a quicker pace towards impeachment, which I suspect will be next Wednesday, is that in past impeachments, Chuck, there was a sense of gravity, a sense of big things are happening here, an epical event in Watergate with Richard Nixon. I remember it. I was a college kid. In the Bill Clinton era, even during his impeachment, there was a sense of gravity that I don't quite sense in the country now. It is not my sense.
Is it cynicism?
That this story, I don't know. People are not enthralled by this. Part of it is that there's no suspense. We know what the House is going to do. We know what the Senate is going to do. So there's no sense of mystery. There's something else. I think in the 70s for Nixon, in the 90s, even for Clinton, there was a greater sense that you could trust institutions, that if the House impeached Bill Clinton, there was probably something to it. I think as a country, it's a banal observation, but nonetheless true. As a country, we have lost faith in institutions and in our leaders to be necessarily doing the right thing. So I think that's part of this. It's just funny to be in on the third impeachment of an American president having a sense of gravity about
exactly.
it.
I know you're good at listening carefully. So did you keep a count on how many things she said that were wrong?
No, because I can't count that high. That's a physics issue.
Okay.
Yeah. But can I just say, this is a podcast, right, so we can say other words, right?
Sure, like bullshit?
Yeah, I was just say, no, it's so funny that occurred to you. I was just say, I almost never do, but you know, especially when you're honoring people who are so dignified. But I think the only word for that is incredible load of bullshit. I don't know, I was in college during Nixon, you know. Yeah, so that means you watched it on TV, right? At best. And then during the Clinton thing, there was a sense of gravity.
No, there wasn't.
Did you see the Onion headlines during the Clinton thing? You know, I mean, the Onion headlines during the Clinton thing were the best in history, right? I mean, it was just the mockery of the whole thing. And then, but the biggest just complete scorching falsehood is we didn't know, or you know, somehow she's leaving it, like, you know, we were a little uncertain or something about what the House was going to do and what the Senate was going to do. Was there anyone who thought that that Republican-controlled House was going to let Bill Clinton off? No. Was there anyone who thought he was going to get convicted in the Senate, at least as the thing developed at any kind of reasonable level? No. She's completely wrong.
Well, and this notion that, you know, that Americans don't care about this, the ratings for the hearings were huge.
And if you look at the polling data on it, yeah, people. One of the things that I'm fascinated by is this line these developments, they haven't moved the numbers that much, right? Well, with all due respect, I know that some people have apparently very short attention spans, but you look at the numbers for the impeachment and the removal from office of Donald Trump from the spring, from when the Mueller report came out to now, do you know what you see? Exponential growth, right? As evidence has developed, as people have gotten more perspective, according to the CNN poll from a week or so ago, 61% of women now favor the impeachment and removal from office of Donald Trump, an overwhelming majority of the majority group in America as regards, you know, gender. And the numbers for African Americans, for all sorts of demographics, through the roof for impeachment. It is true that Trump has a base of supporters, and they have not moved. But the interesting thing is that it's very, very rare in polling that you see them as the majority. And so what I think is that we are a deeply divided country. That's true. No question about it. We are in the midst of an intense discourse about something that is consequential. The deep divisions in the country and, frankly, the collapse of the Republican Party as a you know, any kind of nuanced or big tent party, you know, will probably, not certainly, but probably protect Donald Trump from accountability. But, I think it's sort of amazing to me that people would go on a national program dealing with the impeachment of the President of the United States, a constitutional act of consequence going and significance going back roots-wise to 1787, to the founding of the country, and something that's framed in core concepts of monarchy, you know, liberty, freedom, respect for the office, respect for democracy itself, and they would say, oh, you know what, it's, I don't know, what about you? My mood doesn't feel right. I don't feel right.
Well, why do you think, and maybe you can better analyze this than I, why do you think Chuck Dodd's doing this? This whole thing doesn't feel big to me. Well, what is that about?
I don't even, you know, and I actually, look, as you know, you and I'm a defender of Chuck Todd in a lot of circumstances. I've been on Meet the Press. I've been on Meet the Press daily. I've had good conversations with him over the years, and we may not agree, but I understand, you know, the sense of the politics of it, at least in the discussions on him, quite good. So it's not to beat the guy up, but I think he really, in this case, desperately needs to get out of Washington. You know, get away from D.C. Because the interesting thing is that when you, in D.C., this impeachment, and I think maybe because it intersects with the presidential race, is being analyzed almost entirely as a, you know, a political positioning thing, not as what it is, as this broader, more real struggle. And I think that for, I think many of the hosts just aren't getting to the heart of what's going on. And again, this is the point where punditry has completely overtaken reality. Right?
All right, let's take a break there. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation at slysoffice.com.
I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep slysoffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from slysoffice.com.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson, we love guitars.
Welcome back to slysoffice.com, brought to you by our friends at the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, Madison Firefighters, Local 311, and Madison Teachers Incorporated. All right, so this is just priceless. The senior senator from South Carolina, once again, really dignifying himself.
This thing will come to the Senate, and it will die quickly. And I will do everything I can to make it die quickly. I am trying to give you a pretty clear signal. I have made up my mind. I'm not trying to pretend to be a fair juror here.
Is it appropriate to be voicing your opinion even before this gets to the Senate as a trial?
Well, I must think so, because I'm doing it.
Some people have said, I won't vote for impeachment. Some House members have said, I will not vote for an impeachment. Let me tell you, please don't say that until you understand what you're voting on. Members of the Senate have said, I understand everything there is about this case, and I won't vote to impeach the president. Please allow the facts to do the talking. Nobody knows whether the president, what the articles of impeachment are. People have made up their mind in a political fashion that will hurt this country long term. If you can't vote for impeachment, give us they do justice to the case. Don't decide the case before the case is in. And this bothers me greatly.
Okay. So in addition to that, we have Mitch McConnell, the senior senator from Kentucky and majority leader, saying this.
Everything I do during this, I'm coordinating with White House counsel. There will be no difference between the president's position and our position as to how to handle this. There's no chance the president's going to be removed from office. My hope is that there won't be a single Republican who votes for either of these articles of impeachment.
So when senators start the trial, they sign an oath. They actually walk up to the front of the chamber, and they will have read something that makes them promise to do their due diligence as a juror, that they will be honest and faithful to the Constitution and hear the case with an open mind. They sign it, and it goes into that is in perpetuity. That is the permanent record. How can these people be acting this way?
It's astounding, and of course it's, you know, they do sign an oath. They swear an oath too, by the way, Sly.
They swear an oath. Yes.
They swear one at the start of their term.
Right. This is the very unique thing, because in government this is the only group of people that sign that oath or swear that oath twice.
Yeah, I know, and it's of consequence, because it is. Look, I always say, and as somebody who loves impeachment, thinks it's a great thing, just in general, thinks it's a wonderful, you know, secular sacrament of the American experience, this place that puts people in a position where they can remove the monarchical president before that president.
Secular sacrament. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. I love it. I think impeachment's fantastic. But as somebody says that, I always do remind folks that it is, you know, it's serious medicine you're dealing with here. This does potentially reverse the result of an election. Now, in this case, it doesn't, because Trump lost the popular vote. But, you know, it could. In the case of Nixon, they were talking about somebody who had actually won an overwhelming landslide, right, in the previous election. So it's a big deal thing, and if you get to the point of a Senate trial, you ought to take it seriously. I think on both sides, both parties, and that's your minimal due for the perks of being a senator. So what's going on here? The other thing, in addition to the fact that they have to swear oaths and do, you know, a couple things like that, senators are essentially told you can do whatever you want. You know, they get that message from a lot of directions and in a lot of ways, and they obviously they're working that side of the aisle here. I think it's remarkable that McConnell. I've given up on being surprised by Lindsey Graham, but I think it's remarkable that McConnell has said what he said. I believe it is. A fascinating and full rejection of the system of checks and balances. He is essentially saying we have, without the actual constructs of it, become a parliamentary democracy.
Well, in the same this was on the Sean Hannity show on the Fox News Channel. In the same broadcast, he bragged about killing Merrick Garland's nomination.
Yeah, well, he's a floor leader. You know, he is a parliamentary opposition leader rather than a leader of a legislative chamber.
You know, I think about what a fluke he is. You know, I was reading this the other day. I'm kind of a student of Kentucky politics. So he won by 5,000 votes in the Reagan landslide in 1984. Kentucky was a more Democratic state then.
Much more. Yeah.
And he beat a guy an incumbent by the name of Walter D. Huddleston, who had taken a bunch of junkets and given speeches and gotten paid in miss votes. So
imperfect.
He was an imperfect senator, and he was vulnerable. Did you know, it was either 83 or 84, probably early 84, John Y. Brown, the former governor of Kentucky, who built Kentucky Fried Chicken, who's sort of a business Democrat, very smart, very charming, married to Phyllis George, he would have won easily. He had filed papers to run against Walter D. Huddleston because he knew he was vulnerable, and then he got sick.
Yep. Would have beat him in the primary.
Would have beat him in the primary, and Mitch McConnell wouldn't even have come close.
Mitch McConnell.
Right?
Yeah. Our campaign was based on running against one guy.
Right. And who made those famous ads for Mitch McConnell?
Roger Ailes.
Yeah. So I just think what a fluke that this guy is, and now he's about to run for a seventh term.
Oh, we're going to talk about fluke? Okay. Name me the two U.S. senators who were at the March on Washington in 1963.
Was Fred Harris there?
No. He's sitting U.S. senators currently in the chamber.
Oh, yeah. He didn't get elected until 64. I don't know. Who was there?
Bernie Sanders and Mitch McConnell.
Oh, Mitch McConnell wasn't.
He did not go to March. He was present. You know, he's like observing as an aide. He was working, but he wrote in his autobiography that he shed tears for, you know, finally America was moving in the right direction and stuff like this. I mean,
it must have been raining.
No, I'm not. Mitch McConnell has been on every side of every issue, and the interesting thing about it, though, is he's really. The thing to understand here, and it ought to be underlined, circle, arrows pointed to it, is Mitch McConnell, who has always feared his state, right? He fears Kentucky will turn against him, and he's right to fear it.
He's got an 18% approval rating.
Right, but it's also he faced a tough primary from the most unlikely person ever, Matt Bevin, in the last race.
Matt Bevin's had a good week.
Yeah, fine.
Have you ever heard of an ex-governor having a worse week?
Yeah, well, it's like, somebody said that Matt Bevin has redefined the term monster. You know, pardoning
the guy who killed the woman, cut her head off, and stuffed her in a barrel.
I don't even want to hear the description. It's so awful. But that guy gave Mitch McConnell a pretty hard time in the last round. And so, at some fundamental level, this guy who's always feared his state, and his weak. You know, like just empty tenure and his overwhelming fear that voters might take him out of that office and make him actually have to live a normal life, which you never would, by the way, but, you know, something akin to a normal life, so overwhelming that he has put aside his duties as the, you know, a leading figure in the Senate. And he has fully determined that he's going to use this impeachment as a reelection tool. That's all he's doing here, Sly. He is not helping Donald Trump. Do you really think that making that statement, how would that statement that he made there, that I'm fully coordinating with the White House legal counsel, doing all this stuff like that, there won't be an inch between us, how does that help Donald Trump? Wouldn't it help Donald Trump dramatically more if Mitch McConnell said, we're going to have a fair process. We're going to really listen to both sides, you know, behind the scenes.
Well, somebody said, told me they thought he was sending a message to Donald Trump there, trying to fend off Trump. He doesn't want Trump turning this into a three-ring circus, bringing in Hunter Biden, and that was his way of sort of mollifying Donald Trump.
I understand that, and I hear what you're saying there. But again, even there, what you would say, you know, go over to the White House, sit with the president. Do it three times if you think Trump's not paying attention. But, you know, just say, hey, I'm going to take care of this for you. I'm going to make it work. Trust me. Okay, I stole a Supreme Court nomination under Barack Obama. I know how to manipulate the Senate. But to do it publicly, how does that in any way help Donald Trump? The answer is it doesn't. We're talking about it now. You know, it looks absurd. The only thing he was doing was publicly signaling to Trump, hey, I'm your guy. So, you know, just know that you have to really love me and respect me and support me and be signaling to the Republicans in Kentucky, who frankly don't like McConnell that much more than anybody else, that, you know, he's like this really, he's the Trump boy. He's the Trump guy. And so I just think it's one of the most, I've never seen the role of Senate Majority Leader, and it is, you know, he does lead the Republican majority. We accept that reality. But I've never seen it diminished so thoroughly as it was there. And the other weirdest part about it, Sly, is we talk about Lindsey Graham and we talk about Mitch McConnell. The thing we're missing is they aren't the worst of the Senate in this regard, in regard to this trial that is not likely to come. The worst is unquestionably Ron Johnson. Because Ron,
who?
Ron Johnson.
Who's he?
I know. The senator from Wisconsin, who is, you know, clearly, you know, relatively central to a lot of the incidents that relate to this impeachment. Say, yeah, I'm going to vote on it. And he actually tried to smear one of the key people involved, Vindman. You know, I mean, it's you look at Ron Johnson and the notion that this guy is going to at some point, you know, trot down and swear his oath to be a fair juror. I mean, it's literally, it makes Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell look like, you know, statesmen.
You know, I used to have this romantic view of Wisconsin having a higher standard, you know, having a view of independence and dignity and honesty. And you think of how Russ Feingold handled impeachment versus Ron Johnson. And now I just kind of scratch my head and I'm like, sometimes I don't really feel that proud of my state.
I always feel proud of my state. I'm just not so proud of what's happened in a couple of elections. I will tell you that, you know, you look at Russ Feingold, you look at how Gaylord Nelson handled not just the exit of Nixon, but the insertion of two vice presidents in a short order of time, Gerry Ford and then Nelson Rockefeller, and the questioning and challenging that Nelson brought to that. I mean, really, he dignified and honored Wisconsin at fundamental levels. Wisconsin has a long history with impeachment. Bob Kastemeyer's work on the impeachment committee in 1974 was truly striking and significant. And can I say, I know some folks won't like this, but consider the relative dignity of Jim Sensenbrenner during the Clinton impeachment. Relative.
And yeah, and look at him now.
Yeah, the guy, he himself has become a very different figure than he was then. And frankly, if you'll recall that during the Clinton impeachment, Jim Sensenbrenner and John Conyers actually worked together reasonably well. Opposite sides of the issue, but they at least kept it functional.
The good old days. 1998, the good old days. All right, before we go, there was a discussion about Bernie Sanders versus Jeremy Corbyn after what happened in Great Britain. This is Joe Scarborough with his guest, Edward Luce from Financial Times.
Ed, though, I wonder with Bernie Sanders if we have Corbynism without Corbyn. And I only say that because I remember after the 2016 election, and this shocked, of course, people that are in the media and are in the political class, that are in the political classes. But there were a lot of articles about people who voted for Donald Trump, but would have voted for Bernie Sanders if Sanders actually made the ticket. And that, of course, where would that be?
Right.
Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. Sanders has a certain resonance among working class voters that I think in general elections, we haven't seen evidence of Elizabeth Warren having. A lot of people try to lump these two together. I don't think they go hand in hand in some cases, if you believe, the postmortems in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
There was that famous poll, West Virginia, where Trump beat Hillary, I think, the largest margin other than Wyoming. But if Bernie Sanders had been the Democratic nominee, Sanders would have won 48-46. That was an exit poll. So you should treat it with some skepticism. But it did show a very, very different attitude towards Bernie Sanders than the Corbyn defeat might imply. There is a very big difference between Corbyn and Sanders. Corbyn had the whole Brexit thing, which he resolutely sat on the fence. He was unsectarian on that question, and he faced a party a ruthlessly straightforward message, which is get Brexit done. Three words and a very active verb. As indeed they had in the 2016 referendum, take back control. Labour had a very sort of ambivalent message, like maybe we'll have a referendum, another one, we don't know which side we'll be on. I suspect Sanders, you know, if he were the nominee, would have a pretty active verb and a pretty clear message, and he wouldn't have the whiff of anti-Semitism around him either. So, you know, it's important not to overdo the comparisons between Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn. The differences are probably more important.
Leave it to a Brit to diagram that sentence and focus on active verbs, huh?
Well, and also, to cut through the, again, since it seems to be the active term of
bullshit.
The show, the analysis, or he got right to the heart of the matter. I watched the British election very, very closely. There's a couple of realities. I've been around Jeremy Corbyn. I've known him. I don't know him well. I'm not claiming that, but I've been at events with him and stuff over many years. Nobody would have said, oh, yeah, Jeremy Corbyn, he's going to nail it as, you know, as a leader of the Labour Party in a critical election. He was never seen as that sort of dynamic political leader. He ended up as leader. He did a lot to move the party to the left on a host of issues. Most of what he did, I think, was right. Not all of it, but a lot of it. So it's, I'm not going to beat the guy up, but he was not a great candidate. The campaign was not well run. It was not well focused. And the key to it was there was an issue, Brexit, that you had to take a stand on. You had a Tory candidate, Boris Johnson, leader, with a very clear stand. The Labour Party had unclear stand. And yet, and the final thing is the British voting system, which it's important to understand. Boris Johnson and supporters of Brexit got less votes than opponents of Brexit, right? And or presumably opponents. It's a little complex. But if you put Labour, the Liberal Democrats, and the nationalist parties in Scotland and Wales, as well as a scattering of other progressive folks, Greens and such, they got more votes. It's just that Britain has a voting system that is sort of uniquely beneficial to the Tories in a so-called first-past-the-post.
Well, and Edward Luce also pointed out that Boris Johnson made lots of promises that would make Republicans cringe in America.
Oh.
That sounded a lot like socialism.
He's a so-called one-nation Tory, and so, yes, it was so, but so the only counsel I give here is that there is this free-floating anger in our politics. It's real. It's real in Britain. It's real in the United States. When you saw the Brexit vote back a couple of years ago, it was one of the signals that, yeah, you should take more seriously what's going on. Similar with Trump being a much more viable candidate than a lot of people had expected back in 2016. So you don't underestimate this, but don't make silly arguments. Don't lie to yourself, you know, try and get a situation.
Well, people want a self-fulfilling prophecy, right?
That's right.
Right.
But you know what will happen if you realize that let's say that some of the elites get what they want. They make Joe Biden the Democratic nominee. Do you really think that Joe Biden is somehow, you know, is this clarion candidate? It was so, you know, so clear in his stand, so firm that people, you know, he's like the North Star, and people rally around him in a race. You know, there's no evidence of that throughout history.
No, he has a
much clearer contender.
Well, the other thing here is, although Biden is a skilled politician.
He is skilled, much more skilled than
Hillary Clinton. Yeah. So, and the other thing I guess I would say to these people is like, oh, okay, well, what was Hillary Clinton's candidacy? She certainly was not a left-wing candidate, and she lost blue-collar people. So, I mean, if the right. So this is a little more complicated, and I'm not saying that a candidate can't go too far and put certain people out of reach. And there's social issues versus economic issues, and some of the woke movement, I think, has pushed some blue-collar people away.
I don't even, you and I might actually debate. I actually think that all of that is kind of amplified to the people, the analysts tend to get, oh, that'll scare people away. Here's the bottom line. The bottom line, to my view, is Bernie Sanders is as progressive on social, racial, and economic policies as probably anybody you've seen run, you know, as a major contender for the presidency in a very long time. He dots the I's, he crosses the T's. What is key to him is that people from across many, many demographic categories, race, class, gender, a tremendous number of people, especially working class people, look at him and they say, he sounds real.
I trust him.
I believe him.
Yeah.
And I really think that's at the heart of it. And I'll tell you, if you look at the last couple of national polls that have come out, including there was an NPR Marist poll, stunning his rise. I think the NPR poll, I hope I'm not mistaken, had him within 2 points of Biden nationally now.
Yeah. I mean,
Yeah, doing very well in California. Well, there are a lot of interesting cross currents in the world with the rise of right-wing nationalism in Europe, what happened with Great Britain. And in Canada, the conservatives are at each other's throats, and you have candidates running now. The conservative leader, Andrew Scheer, was pushed out, who are openly advocating that the party become more liberal and talk about climate change and talk about gay rights. Now, that, my friend, is a sea change.
It is a sea change. And can I tell you, you say, oh, that could never happen. In Britain, never forget. Now, he screwed up. He ended up as a horrible prime minister, in my view. But look at how David Cameron took over the Tory party after Thatcher and all the, you know, awful struggles of the Tory party. You know, once Thatcher went and Major finally lost, the Tories had a long period in the wilderness. And then they finally had a guy come along, David Cameron, who said, we're not going to be jerks anymore. Literally. That was his core message, is we're not going to be a bunch of people that, you know, try to divide the country and really, you know, are just horrible people. We were going to stop being that. And the amazing thing is that Cameron won, you know, very significant victories.
Let me ask you real quick as we wrap this up, because we are going long today. You know, in Canada, there's talk about a serious breakup of the country with Alberta and Saskatchewan leaving. I don't think that's going to happen, but there's a lot of effort to do so. In Great Britain, you have Scotland and you have Northern Ireland. How much are we close to the precipice here?
Well, it's a little bit away because in Britain, at least at the baseline, the Tory government has to allow for votes. Right? I mean, for referendum votes on whether to leave. And I don't think that Boris Johnson is likely to let that happen because of the problem of doing so. But if the pressure becomes sufficient to allow for a Scottish independence referendum, I mean, I think that Scotland, I believe that Scotland, which came very close to voting for independence in the last election, would do so. After everything that's happened, it's not just this election, it's everything over the last few years. I think Scotland very clearly could see a way for itself to be essentially part of Scandinavia, you know, unique country, but one much more like Norway, Sweden. And then as regards Northern Ireland, that's where it becomes much more difficult. I think they're playing with fire there. You know, for the first time...
Literally.
Well, that's what I'm saying. This is very complex, very... You still have tensions and struggles on the ground there that go back hundreds of years, and they're creating an unstable situation. To give you a sense of it, just in one line here, for the first time in history, on election day last week, Northern Ireland, more nationalists, people of parties that sympathize with a united Ireland, did well than the hardcore, you know,
Ulster.
Allies of
mm-hmm.
UK. Mm-hmm. And so the end result is that everything has been shaken up at a fundamental level. And when that happens, people just look naturally at logical solutions. And what is the logic of having, you know, a handful of counties in Northern Ireland be separate from the rest of Ireland?
All right. I'm going to put you on the spot, and I'm going to ask you to do your best Ron McRae. Okay? You ready? I'm putting you on the spot here.
I know, yeah.
All right?
Slide.
Write the headline for for this podcast.
Okay. Headline for this podcast.
Bullshit?
No,
he wouldn't use that word, no.
Yeah,
we'll tell the whole story.
Exposing the bullshit.
Well, we'll say, in Ron's honor, we'll say BS, okay?
Yeah, exposing the BS. Yeah, because he probably would class it up a little.
All right.
Correctly so.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Thanks for coming to Sly's Office.
Sly's Office.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.